We're doing Parshat Shmot. We'll do a quick overview and then we'll begin with more depth. Our parsha begins with the recounting of the children of Yaakov. Yosef passes away, a new king. He views us as a threat. He tells the nation, we have to take care of these people. And so they start taxing us and they point us to build storage cities for Pharaoh. And as much as they afflict us, we just multiply more and more and they become disgusted with us. And they start making us work, back-breaking work. They try to embitter our lives, and nothing helps. So finally, Pharaoh calls on the midwives and tells them when the children are born, so kill all the boys. And the midwives don't do that. They're summoned to the king, and they give an excuse. They say, you know, by the time we get there, the kids are already born. We can't say it was a stillbirth. They see it already, and so Pharaoh comes up with a new decree, throw all the boys into the Nile. The Torah tells us an interesting story. This Levite marries the daughter of Levi, and she has a son. What an amazing son. She hides him for 3 months, and then she's scared she'll get caught. She can't hide him anymore. She puts him in the Nile, and the sister stands from afar to see what's going on. Pharaoh's daughter comes to the Nile. She sees the baby. She takes him. And she sees it's a Jewish baby. She says, okay, we need someone to nurse him. They pay. The sister comes up and says, I'll bring you a Jewish woman. And then the girl's own mother, the boy's own mother, nurses him and gets paid for it. And that's the famous boy is Moshe. Moshe, once he's old enough, he stops nursing. He's brought to the palace. He grows up in the palace. One day he walks out of the palace and he wants to see how his brothers are doing. He knows he's a Jew. And he sees an Egyptian beating up a Jew, and he kills the Egyptian. And the next day, the Jew tells him that he sees that same Jew fighting with his own brother. And he says, hey, what are you beating your brother up for? And the guy says, who are you to judge us? I'm going to tell the king. And so Moshe has to run away to Midian. When he comes to Midian, so we see that honesty bursts forth. He sees the shepherds that want to rape the 7 girls, that want to steal their sheep, and he saves them, and he gives the sheep to drink, and then he's brought in before Yisro. And in a minute, when we review the parsha again, so we'll discuss who Yisro is. He has children, and then he sees the great vision of the bush that burns and doesn't get consumed, and Hashem says, this is the place over here. This is Mount Sinai. Sinai is not really its name. Until that day, it was called Mount Horeb. It gets the name Mount Sinai then with the vision of the burning bush. And God sends him with the signs to tell the people that God is going to take them out of Egypt. And he comes and everything just gets worse. And the king makes worse decrees on them. They have to get their own hay, their own make their own mortar. And the people come and they wail at him, it's all your fault. And Moshe turns to Hashem and says, what'd you send me for? You see, I said all along I wasn't the right one to go. Things only got worse since I came. And Hashem says, okay, now I'm going to show you what the whole plan is. So now let's see the parsha with more depth. Our parsha, yes, Uri.
What does
the
Russian
community
say that God is like?
He beat them up. He was 20 foot tall. He picked up a stick. He picked up some rocks. He did some karate moves and he beat up all the shepherds. What? He was 20 feet tall, yeah. I'm serious.
It said he's 20 feet tall?
No, the Gemara in Sota says he's 20 feet tall. So, yeah. What?
Is there an explanation how he was reasonable, how he was appeared in the Mount Horeb? Because in the map, Midian is somewhere here, let's say. And Mount Sinai is there. So he had to go all this distance just to go there. Is there any reasonable way why he took the flock in such a great distance?
Yeah, because it's a long answer. Maybe we'll get to it. And if not, remind me tomorrow night. We have question and answer. We'll get back to it. Yeah, tomorrow's a chol night. Tomorrow we learn till 1, 2 in the morning here. You guys are all invited. Okay, we ended the book of Bereishis with a message. Pakod yifkod Elokim etchem. Hashem tells Yaakov, tells them, you're going to get out of it. And that sometimes is the message we have to remember. It's going to end. One of the most difficult things is the thought, it's not going to end. My wife's grandfather entered Auschwitz. He asked the Jew there, how do you get out of here? And the Jew pointed to the chimneys and he said, the only way out is a smoke. That's how you're going to leave. And he quotes that every time we have a bris. One of the great things we have to remember, and that's the message that the book of Bereishis ends with, is Pakod Yifkod Elokim Etchem Mizeh. Remember, Hashem is there, and He's going to take you out of this. The Mishnah tells us in Pirkei Avot, Al Tityesh Min HaPuranut. A Jew never gives up just because things are hard. And so our parsha begins where the Jews are going to disobey what Yaakov told them. Yaakov told them, stay here in Goshen. Stay unified. Stay together. Yaakov ensured that everyone was married when they entered Mitzrayim because Yaakov knew that the great bastion of Jewish strength is the home. And if they could only hold on to the homes, then they could stand up to the test of being in Mitzrayim. But they didn't listen to Yaakov. They became successful and they moved out of Goshen. And it was when they moved out of Goshen that the Egyptians started to feel a demographic threat. The Egyptians started saying, hey, look at them, everywhere you turn, there are Jews. Now, they weren't simple Jews. They were having six Jews at a time. Not only six Jews at a time, usually you have that number of babies. The babies are little, scrawny things. You ever see what twins look like, triplets look like? Six babies? Six babies should have been minuscule. No. Bnei Israel Rabu, they were huge. You're talking about big macho builders. You see, Moshe was a 20-footer. Could you imagine you're walking down the street? Think about it here. You're walking down the street, and everywhere you look, you see another Arab family, and every family has 30 kids, which are bigger than your ceiling. You wouldn't be too happy. So the Egyptians, well, every time a Jewish woman has a baby, she's got six, and six that are big. The Egyptians say to themselves, you know, right now we could take them down. But if they wait for a time when we're busy out at war, we're not going to be able to take them down. So Paro turns against them. And Paro figures, I have to break their spirit. And that's why Paro makes them work Avodas Parech. Avodas Parech has two meanings in Chazal. We have a biblical prohibition for making a Jewish slave work Avodas Parech. And it is defined either as work that is limitless. You tell him, you start digging, and I'll get back to you. Keep digging. And you walk away. You didn't give him a limit. You didn't tell him to dig 10 feet, 20 feet, 50 feet. You just said, you keep digging. So that's Avodas Parech. Because psychologically, to keep working and you have no idea when you're going to end, that's called Avodas Parech. That's one definition. The other definition is pointless work. You tell the guy, yesterday you dug that hole, today take the earth you dug out, put it back in. When you're done, dig it out again. That's Avodas Parech, pointless labor. There was a guy in Russia who was in jail. He spent 30 years. Every morning they take him to a wall. And by that wall there was a handle. And he cranked that handle all day. And after 30 years they finally let him out of jail. He was an old man. 30 years in jail. And when they let him out of jail, so he said to his relative, he said, look, all this time I was cranking that handle. I wanted to know what I was doing. Was I grinding flour for families? Was I making an electric turbine move? What was I doing? I don't know. All I know is they had this handle that was really hard to crank, and I was doing it all day. So his driver took him around the jail to show him the other side of his room, and they figure out, and they see the other side of the room, there's nothing. And he realizes that for 30 years, they had him turning that handle for nothing, and he had a heart attack right there, dropped dead. 30 years cranking the handle didn't kill him. But to see that there was nothing, that pointless work, that breaks a person. And that's what the Mitzrayim wanted to do. They wanted to break us. And they made us do work that was dangerous. They'd make the Jews pick their lice out of their clothing. That's not too dangerous. But then they'd make them go hunting for bears and lions. And they'd tell them, by the end of the day, you got to bring me a lion. You got to bring me a bear. They closed down the mikvahs. From the days of Avram Avinu, Am Yisrael was careful. Their wives would immerse in mikveh. They were careful in the laws of family purity, as we see with Rachel. And the Mitzrayim closed that down. They figured if we close the mikvahs, then they won't be mate with their wives, and then there won't be any Jews around. And that's why the Nile turned to blood. Hashem said, you thought you're going to mess around with their blood, I'm going to mess around with your blood. You made them... What? I don't know. Maybe they went to the Nile. Maybe they found ways of going differently. The Egyptians made them hunt for wild animals. They're going to get a plague of wild animals. The Egyptians made them clean up the streets from garbage. So Hashem sent them the plague of frogs, which turned into garbage and stank up their streets. But the Jews were made to do every type of work you could imagine. And the men were made to do women's work, and the women were made to do men's work. And the men broke down. The men would work so hard that they tell their wives, I'm not going home, what's the point? Within an hour or two, they're going to call me back out to work. I'm going to go to sleep out here in the field. And that was what the Egyptians wanted. Keep them so busy that they don't even go home. Now the women were doing men's work, so they were carrying bricks and mortar and building. And the men, well, they were doing women's work. They were baking and, you know, sewing. And the women would come out to the field, and they'd take out these little pocket mirrors they had, and they'd sit down and they'd start putting an ointment on their husband's back and cooing to them, sitting under the apple trees, talking to them sweetly. And then they'd go out and fetch a bucket with water, and they'd get the water from a place where there were all kinds of little fish. And then they'd put it up on a fire, and they'd have water and fish. And then they wouldn't go home, because the men didn't have strength to go home. They'd go in between the fields. Every field would end up, they'd make the earth go up a little bit to signify the end of that field. So they'd sleep together in between two fields. You had this little furrow, you had a little modest place, that's where they'd sleep together. So all the Egyptian plans to overcome the Jews didn't overcome the Jewish secret weapon. What's the Jews' secret weapon? The women. That's our secret weapon.
Why didn't the Egyptians kick all the Jews out of
Egypt? It's a good question. This was part of God's decree. Meaning it didn't have to play itself out this way. They didn't have to view us as a threat. We were a great asset to them. We were as faithful as Yosef was. Yosef could have taken all the money for himself. He didn't. He made Pharaoh rich. We were also faithful citizens. But the more we became faithful citizens, the more Hashem made them hate us. my grandmother told me, my grandmother, may she rest in peace, told me that in Germany, they had the Yad, the little hand that the Baal Kore holds to read from the Torah. So it was a silver yad in their shul, the big shul in Frankfurt. And engraved on it was the name of two soldiers who lost their lives in World War I on behalf of Germany. Meaning the German Jews were very proud that they had children from their congregation that gave up their lives on behalf of Germany in World War I. So the Nitziv writes on our Parsha that this is a repeated theme throughout Jewish history, and it begins in Egypt. The Jews try to be very faithful citizens, and Hashem reminds them that it's not going to work. The more they try to be faithful to the culture they live in, the more Hashem makes that culture hate them. The more they're faithful to their own heritage, the more that culture respects them. This, says the Nitziv, is a recurring theme, and it begins in the Jewish exile in Egypt. So, I forgot to mention in the beginning of our learning, I'll mention now, we were asked to dedicate our learning tonight to the memory of Yisachar Tzvi ben Mordechai. It's his yahrzeit tonight. Yisachar Tzvi ben Mordechai. Jala Rosmarin. So, the Egyptians make the Jewish lives bitter. And the Egyptian stargazers see that there's going to be a Jewish boy who's going to lead a mass rebellion against the Egyptians and take all their wealth and destroy them. And they tell Pharaoh that. So Pharaoh says, okay, he calls in the midwives and he says, you look on the birthing stone, if it's a boy, you kill him and tell the mother it was a stillbirth. And if it's a girl, keep her alive. And Pharaoh figures they'll have all these girls. The Egyptians are very promiscuous, so they're happy to have all these Jewish girls around. The midwives could think to themselves a lot of things. They could have said to themselves, well, he's going to kill us. Well, if we don't do it, someone else will do it. There are all kinds of excuses people give themselves when they do something wrong. But they didn't. And that's called Vatir'ena HaMiyaledot Et Elokim. They were fearful of God. We have to know that we will all have moments in our lives where we will be tempted to give excuses. Deep down inside, we will know that there is a very clear moral question going on here. And we will have to face that question. And the formula for facing that question is what the Mialdot had to say to themselves. Tatir'ena ha-mialdot et ha-elokim. Hashem is watching. Very often we think, I could get away with it. And it's wrong, but who will know? It's wrong, but I have a million excuses. If I don't do this, who knows? Maybe there'll be a pogrom. You know, the Mialdot could have said, if we just play along with this, then... And here maybe I'll share with you a story about the person we dedicated our learning to tonight, Yisachar Tzvi ben Mordechai. When the Germans came into town, so they appointed young Jewish men to be policemen on behalf of the Germans. And so they went over to Yisachar Tzvi ben Mordechai. He was a big businessman in Sosnowitz, in a town in Poland. And they said to him, you're such a respected person in the community and you have such a fine son. Why isn't your son in our police force? And he said, you want my son to police other Jews on your behalf? Never. And whoever had a son who was in the police force got all kinds of benefits from the Germans. And... it was a big honor, so to speak, in the system to have a son in that police force, and they were the last to be deported. And he said, never, not my son. And they beat him up. They took him outside, they beat him up to the point where they broke his nose for the rest of his life. He had a broken nose. They brought soldiers with their boots and they threw him to the ground and they trampled all over his face and his body, knocked him unconscious and left him all bloody. But that's the choice we have in life. And that's the temptation. And I'm telling you, every one of you will have those moments where you're going to have to make that decision. It's not easy. And those are the moments that define us in life. And when a person makes the right decision, so then he reaps the benefits of that decision for generations to come. And that's what happens with the Mialedot. That Hashem, in payback, they are the source of the Jewish monarchy. They are the source of the priests. That they are the source of prophets. They became great houses in Israel. So, the plan didn't work. So Paro finally makes a decree that they should throw all Jewish boys into the Nile. And the stargazers come back and say, well, what we've seen is that the boy might be from an Egyptian home, because we see in the stars that it seems like he's going to grow up in an Egyptian home. So Pharaoh says, okay. The stargazers say, today he was born. And so Pharaoh decrees, today all male children that were born get thrown into the Nile. The stargazers come back the next day and they say, Pharaoh, according to the stars, he's still alive. And so the decree goes on for a month, for 2 months, for 3 months. Everyone's babies are being thrown into the Nile. All baby boys that were born that time. After 3 months, Yocheved sees that she can't contain the baby. They're going to hear about him. She had kept him hidden. The Egyptians didn't think he was born yet. And so after 3 months, she takes him and puts him in the Nile. And the Egyptians tell Pharaoh, we see that the babies hit the Nile. She figures, they're looking at the stars, and now they're saying that the Jewish baby has not yet been thrown into the Nile. Well, now they're going to see that the baby was thrown into the Nile, and that's why she put him in the Nile. What? Okay, I guess they didn't know this yet, until this point. And so at that point, they put him in the Nile, and Pharaoh, the stargazers, rush in, and they say, we just saw now, the baby hit the Nile. So Pharaoh tells the people, okay, you could stop throwing babies in. And that's why Moshe Rabbeinu will say later on in the Torah, you guys all owe it to me. My mother risked my life to save all of your lives. when she got wind of what was going on, so she did this plan and put him in a casket in the Nile, because she could have just as well taken him out into the desert or somewhere. They could have hidden him elsewhere. No, she wanted the decree to stop, and she was successful. Now, there's a story here. Remember, Amram marries his aunt Yocheved. Amram is a grandson of Levi. His aunt Yocheved is a daughter of Levi. This is a relationship that's biblically prohibited after the Torah was given. But prior to the Torah being given, so this was permitted. Yes?
Was there any great person who did not marry relatives? I don't mean this like any new community, but the testimony is that every single person married a relative would be considered unacceptable today. But all too often, like,
why?
Like their sisters and things like that, that would be prohibited today.
Only before the Torah was given. After the Torah was given, so they all married other people. Kalev married other people. Yoshua married other people. From the time the Torah was given, you find people marrying other people.
That means the Torah permits marriage from someone who is cousin.
Cousin or niece, but not aunt.
How's that different from niece or aunt?
Good question.
The sister of your mother, and the sister of your father, or sister of your father's daughter.
Who says this moment being so troubling? Because I read in the commentaries that this person married this person, not only would be a lady to him, but they were like 6 years old at the time. I mean, things that would like absolutely never apply.
Okay. But people were different then. Life was different then. Why, as a 12-year-old is a baby, but then a 12-year-old was marriageable age. Homework. Uri. How old was Cleopatra when everyone was fighting over her? Leave Chazal. Homework, you tell us tomorrow. How old was Cleopatra? World war over her. Yeah.
But I'm thinking that all time we hear that, for example, Yaakov Avinu was staying in tents studying Torah. What exactly he was studying? He was not, first of all, studying the most important things, which is the relationships between who can you marry?
Good question. There's Hashem tomorrow, you could ask him. Try to deal with it. So we have Amram, who is the Gadol Hador. He's the leader of the people. And he marries his aunt. And when the Egyptians decree that they're going to throw all the baby boys into the Nile, so Amram tells his wife, what are we working so hard for? That's it, it's over. There's no future to the people. And so he divorces her. And when he divorces her, everyone divorces their wives. And he has a little girl named Miriam. Miriam was named after the terrible decrees of the Egyptians. When things got really, really bad, she was born. And that's why she was named Miriam. Comes from the word maror. Things became really bitter. And she comes to her dad and she says, Dad, you're worse than Pharaoh. So her father says, why? She says, well, Pharaoh, he only decreed that the boys would get killed, and you're decreeing that there will be no boys or girls. How can you do that? That's terrible. And her father says, you're right. And so he remarries his wife. And that's why this parsha became the symbolic parsha about the importance of bringing Jewish children to the world, which people sometimes underestimate. People think, birth control, what's wrong? We're delaying it by 3 years. You're not delaying it by 3 years. You're forgoing three children. Now, the children you could have these 3 years are not going to come to the world. And if God will bless you and you'll have children in 3 years, so you'll have children in 3 years. We have to realize the greatness of what happened here. The people of Israel were willing to bring children to the world when they thought 50% would be killed. And the other 50%, who knows if they'll ever live. But that's what we began with. The strength of the Jewish people is pakod pakati. Hashem will remember us. He will take us out of this situation. We don't give up. And there's nothing that will make us give up. So Amram remarries Yocheved. You ask Amram, hey buddy, what do you think is going to happen? Amram says, maybe I'll have a baby boy. And maybe he'll be thrown into the Nile. But maybe he will have a baby boy who will save the people of Israel. So when Amram remarries Yocheved, what does Amram think? I'm bringing children to the world who will die. Amram remarries Yocheved thinking nothing good is going to come of this. There's a potential of 50% that will live. And nonetheless, Amram remarries Yocheved. I'll get to you in 1 second, Uri. Now let's see the behind the scenes of what happened here. In truth, when Amram and Yocheved divorced, Yocheved was pregnant with Moshe, the one who will ultimately save the Jewish people. The only reason the Egyptians weren't onto it was because she started showing late in her pregnancy. Let's say Amram would have said, I'm not remarrying Yocheved. No point. What good is going to come of it? Then the Egyptians would see in a month or two that Yocheved is pregnant, and they'd do the math, and they'd say, okay, when did she become pregnant? Before the divorce. And they'd know exactly when to expect Moshe's delivery. The only reason the Egyptians were fooled was because they were divorced for 3 months, they got remarried, and the Egyptians, when they saw her pregnant, they started the count from their second marriage. And that's what gave Moshe Rabbeinu 3 months to live. And then ultimately he was thrown into the Nile, and then he was saved. Had the Egyptians caught Moshe when he was born, they would have killed him. Had Amram not remarried Yocheved, then Moshe would have been killed. So Amram remarries Yocheved thinking, I'm remarrying her for the sake of Hashem, even though I might lose every boy I have, when in fact by remarrying her, that's what ensures the life of the boy that he is about to have. And you will see this theme recurring throughout Tanakh. If we do what's right, then Hashem sort of takes care of things that they work out right. Just what you think you're going to save yourself from by doing something wrong, Hashem shows you, no, by doing what's right, it's going to be okay. Yehuda had the same challenge a few weeks ago. Yehuda was with Tamar. So Yehuda is very tempted to be quiet. Let her burn. Yehuda is going to save face if he keeps quiet. But Yehuda is a man. Yehuda does what's right. He stands up and says, no, it's my fault. I did it. And in saying, I did it, Yehuda saves her life and the children's life, and ultimately, that is the greatness of Yehuda. He becomes our leader because he was willing to admit, I did it. If you'd have asked Yehuda 5 minutes earlier, what's going to happen when you admit? Yehuda would have said, I'm going to get shame. No one's going to respect me anymore. But I have to do it. That's what's right. And the truth is the exact opposite. By doing it, he gained the respect, he gained the leadership of Am Yisrael. Yeah, Uri.
Something that I look at this and it being very shallow, not the case at all, and I really don't want to believe this is the case, but it almost seems as if everyone was married to the wives only for the children, and if they can't have children, there's no point in staying married to their wives.
Because their children would be killed, not because they only want to have children.
Shouldn't there be more to the relationship like, oh, I married you just for the kids, and if you're not like capable of having kids, then all of a sudden I don't care about you anymore, and then sorry, it seems you're on your own.
Who says he didn't care for her? The Talmud tells us that when the rabbis had situations where they had to get divorced, they took very good care of their exes. Doesn't have to mean that. The fact that they're divorced
obviously
only means...
there are certain ways you can't be there for them anymore. You can't...
Maybe. Okay, but maybe it was worth it. If he felt that right now we should cave into the decree and avoid having our children killed, for whatever reason he felt that, he obviously felt that was a worthwhile price to pay.
So what if a wife becomes incapable of having children? Not necessarily that the baby should be killed.
Okay, it's a good question. Okay. Right. Okay. Remember, she was 120 something years old. I'm not sure anyone was interested. So Pharaoh's own daughter decides that she's going to convert to monotheism, and Pharaoh's daughter Batya takes on the name Batya. Paro didn't give her that name. Batya means daughter of God. That's because she came and converted to Judaism. So she adopted the name Batya. Ko, the daughter of Hashem. And she goes to the Nile, and she's immersing for the sake of converting to Judaism. Pharaoh's own daughter. She thought she was a very intelligent and pious woman, and she came to the conclusion, the Jews are right, monotheism is right. Don't forget, up until 6 years ago, 6 years before this story, the Jews held high positions in Egypt. They held positions of prominence. Not only Yosef. It's not surprising. We don't know how much time passed between Yosef and this Pharaoh. Figure, we're in Egypt a total of 210 years, right? Moshe is born 80 years before we come out of Egypt. So now you're up to 130 years since we came to Egypt. Yosef is king in Egypt for 80 years. So that's 50 years. So there was about a 50-year gap between Yosef's passing away and the... You had 44 years between Yosef's passing away and all the terrible decrees. He had 44 years. It's not a long time.
Was it even like halacha then? Or going to the mikveh?
Oh, that's a good question. That's a good question, right? What does going to the mikveh have anything to do with it? Right. So that's a good question, right? You're right. So she will join the Jews in Yetzias Mitzrayim. And she will ultimately marry Kalev. And she and Moshe's sister will share the same husband. This same Miriam and Batya will both be married to Kalev. Kalev ends up marrying both. So they shared a husband, Kalev and Batya. But right now they don't know that. So Batya converts to Judaism and the little girl Miriam comes down and she gives her the advice, I'll get you a Jewish wet nurse. And Batya gives Moshe the name Moshe. Moshe means I pulled him out. And Moshe really means he will pull. Mashui means he was pulled. And this is an allusion to the great future Moshe has ahead of him. Moshe grows up. Who's teaching him? Batya. Remember, she's a monotheist. So she raises him as a Jew. She doesn't have to tell him that Yocheved is his real mother, but somehow he knew. And somehow he had a relationship with Aaron. It would seem that maybe Batya allowed that to happen. So he had this adopted brother, at least in Batya's mind, it was his adopted brother. And he maintains a relationship with him. And Moshe grows up, he's 15 years old. He goes outside and he sees an Egyptian beating a Jew to death. What's the story? You guys know the story behind the scenes? The Egyptian had slept with his wife and the Jew caught on. Yeah, you guys know the story? Yeah? No. Okay. So the Egyptian was scared the Jew would squeal to Pharaoh and that he'd get in trouble. What happened was, it was the middle of the night. Dasan was lying in bed. He had only 3-4 hours that the Egyptian would let him sleep. And the Egyptian liked the looks of Dasan's wife, Shlomis Bas Divri. So she was always nice and she'd speak to everyone, including the Egyptians. And so the Egyptian comes in the middle of the night and he says, Dasan, get out of bed, time to go to work. So Dasan is half groggy, doesn't know what's doing, walks out to the field, starts working. The Egyptian slips back into Dasan's bed and sleeps with Dasan's wife. She's half asleep, she thinks it's Dasan. The Egyptian leaves the house and Dasan was standing out there in the dark working and suddenly he realizes, hey, there's no one here. What's wrong with me? What am I out here for? So he comes back home. Dasan comes back home, gets back into bed and his wife asks him, what's going on here? You leave, you come back, you leave, you come back. Dasan says, what do you mean leave, come back? This is the first time I came back. And then Dasan figures out what happened. So Dasan comes storming out of the house and the Egyptian sees him. And the Egyptian sees the look on Dasan's face and he figures out that Dasan figured out what just transpired. So the Egyptian knocks him off his feet and starts beating him. So everyone's going to think that the Jew wasn't living up to his quota, wasn't doing his work properly, but the Egyptian has in mind, I'm going to beat him till he's dead. I'm not going to let word get out of what I did. So... So it seems that although Pharaoh could get the Egyptians convinced to hurt the Jews, there was a certain limit to how far he could go. You see that originally he didn't feel he would get away with killing the Jewish babies. He had to ask the midwives for a trick in how to do it. Over time, he caused the Egyptians to think that the Jews were scum, and then he could get away with it. There are certain things that every regime has to enforce in order to maintain their own legitimacy in the eyes of their people. So this guy, obviously, this he was scared of. Now, Moshe walks onto the scene. Moshe just walked out of the palace. It's his first day out. He wants to see how the Jews are doing. And he comes to the scene and he hears what happened. And he understands exactly what happened. And he kills the Egyptian. He says God's hidden name. The Egyptian drops dead. He buries him in the sand and he tells the Jews that are standing around there, shh, this is our secret. The very next day, Moshe comes out again. And that same Dasan is having a fight with his brother Aviram. And he lifts his fist. What?
That's very unlucky.
He lifts his fist to hit his brother. And Moshe says, Russia. And from here we paskin in Halacha also, that someone just lifts a fist to hit someone else, that's called a Russia, even before he hit him. And Dasan turns to him and says, who do you think you are? Who appointed you? You're going to kill me like you killed the Egyptian? And he yells it. And Moshe sees that he's in trouble. Moshe gets caught by Paro's executioners. Moshe is brought to judgment before the executioners. And they rule that Moshe deserves to be killed for having killed an Egyptian. They bring him into execution. And the sword, the executioner lifts his sword and comes down hard to slice off Moshe's head, and Hashem makes his head get hard as a rock. And the Moshe walks off the pedestal. And the guy who sees him walk off the pedestal was supposed to guard him. Hashem makes him mute. He suddenly can't talk. He tries to yell after Moshe, but no words come out. Moshe starts walking out the door and the guy wants to run after him and suddenly he becomes blind.
The guy steps and the next, dark room with the knife and Moshe hits him with the bed.
The next guy, he should have heard Moshe walk out and he becomes deaf and Moshe just walks out scot-free, runs out to Midian. Now, in Midian, there's a man named Yisro. And by the way, this is what Hashem is going to quote to Moshe. When Moshe says, I don't know how to talk well, Hashem is going to say, gee, I showed you that I control your neck, I control who could hear, I control who could speak, I control who could see. I showed you all that. So you know that. So why are you arguing with me and saying, you can't speak well? I showed you once in your life that I control, and that's how I saved you. So in Midian, we have a man named Yisro. Yisro is a man who... he was one of Paro's top three advisors. Paro had Iov, Bilam, and Yisro as his advisors. And when Paro was contemplating what to do with the Jewish people, so Bilam said the whole plan, throw their babies in the Nile, break their spirits. Iov was silent and Yisro ran away. Iov was silent. He ended up suffering the rest of his life. Yisro ran away. Yisro became part of the Jewish people and his descendants became the great leaders of the Jewish people. His descendants sat in the highest court. And Bilam ultimately also left his post and led people to victory. He led a team to conquer a city when their men were out at war. He conquered the whole city and took over their wives. And all the warriors were stuck outside the city gates until Moshe came along. And Moshe told them the secret of how to overcome the fortifications of their own city and showed them how to reconquer their city. They took back hold of their city and Bilam ran away. And they wanted to appoint Moshe king of the city, but that would involve Moshe's marrying the former queen. And Moshe didn't want to do that. And that's why ultimately Moshe left them and went out to Midian. So Moshe comes out to Midian. And Yisro, when he left Paro's palace, had taken with him something that was in Yosef's treasure chest. Remember, Paro took over all of Yosef's wealth. And included in Yosef's wealth was a great staff made of sapphire that came out of the Garden of Eden. And that staff had God's hidden name on it, and it also had the acronym Ditzach Hadash Be'achav. Yisro brought it with him when he ran away from Pharaoh. He knew it didn't really belong to Pharaoh. It was an unusual staff. And he put it in his garden, and then when he tried to pull it out, it wouldn't come out. And he, as hard as he would try, he couldn't get it out. And he asked a lot of people to try, and no one else could get it out. And when Moshe comes to Midian, so the daughters of Yisro come out to the well. Now, no one likes Yisro, because Yisro was a monotheist, and everyone else was pagans. So the shepherds give his daughters a hard time. Now, one of the traits of a prophet is that he's honest and he cannot stand injustice. So even though Moshe's on the run, and it's none of his business, but when he sees seven innocent girls coming and trying to feed their sheep, and the shepherds start heckling them, so Moshe steps into the scene, even though it's none of his business. He's a newcomer. And this is a perfect shidduch for Moshe, because Yisro is on the run from Pharaoh, and Yisro is a monotheist, and Yisro is unpopular, so Moshe found the perfect shidduch, a misfit just like himself. Word won't get back to Egypt, Pharaoh won't chase after him, because Pharaoh won't get word that he's here, because Yisro is a fugitive from Pharaoh too. This is the perfect shidduch. But things don't turn out the way Moshe expected. Yisro is scared of Pharaoh, and he says, why should I have the trouble of Pharaoh coming after me? If Pharaoh catches me that I took in his fugitive adopted son, I'll be in double hot water. And so Yisro takes Moshe and throws him into a dungeon without any food or water, and we'll pick up here tomorrow night, Bezachim.